be seated.
And our last representation case is Pesley versus Neal. So ready to proceed.
May it please the court, Ms. Pamela Stanton Barron will present the argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is an oil and gas case in which the Neal family is the lessor and ATCI the lessee under a standard oil and gas lease. There's one other important player, that's AOP Operating Company. They're not a party to this litigation, but they operated wells on land immediately adjacent to the Neal lease in Fayette County. It's undisputed that AOP engaged in illegal production that caused waste and violated Railroad Commission rules and regulations. ATCI brought three separate actions to stop AOP. ATCI initiated proceedings at the Railroad Commission of Texas in 1985 and in 1988.
You were successful with those efforts to stop the rule.
Yes, they were. In 1989, ATCI obtained permanent injunctive relief in Fayette County from the district court there. In addition, ATCI recovered a judgment for damages to ATCI's reserve caused by AOP. There's no question both the Neals have their own direct cause of action against AOP.
Let me ask you a quick question about those damages. Can you point to any evidence in the record that makes it clear that the damages that ATCI recovered from AOP was basically 5-6?
I'm sorry, basically?
5-6 was...
Yes, but I think we can look at a couple things. First, one, ATCI couldn't sue on the Neals' behalf. They didn't have an assignment. And the court just correctly held they had no right to sue. But also, if you look at page 307 and 08 of the record,
what pages?
307 through 308. There, they're using a $6.50 a barrel price for oil, which is testified to be the price in the ground to the working interest owner. And elsewhere in the record, it shows that the actual sale price of oil on the barrel would be $17. So it's a reduced price of the working owner's price. And that testimony ties directly to Plaintiff's Exhibit 21, which again ties exactly to the number that the jury put into the verdict, which asked about ATCI standards.
Thank you.
Okay. The Neals had their own suit against AOP under this court's decision in Gila versus Texon Drilling and also a statutory right of action under the Natural Resources Code. But as you know, they sued ATCI, not AOP, claiming entitlement to a 1/6 royalty share in the AOP judgment. This court's going to review on two issues. The first question is whether ATCI had an implied duty to tell the Neals about the AOP judgment and tell the Neals that they needed to go out and file their own lawsuit. Second question is whether information is publicly available to the Railroad Commission of Texas and it's publicly disseminated in the local and trade press is somehow inherently undiscoverable, saving the Neals claims here from the bar of the statute of limitations. I'd like to talk about the discovery rule issue first. I know the court's heard a lot about it. I think the Neals and their amici have pretty well substantially confused this issue. And I think we need to start with Altai, where the court recognized there are two separate questions. And the first question is, as a matter of law, does the discovery rule apply to this case? And that's the question here. Only if the discovery rule applies to the court to the second question, which you've just heard a lot about, and that is the discovery rule satisfied? When or whether should this plaintiff known or should have known of the injury? The Neals want to skip the first question. Here's what they're arguing. They're arguing the discovery rule always applies unless the individual plaintiff knows of the injury, either by actual notice or through constructive knowledge, which is the legal equivalent of actual notice, or the individual plaintiff should have known of the injury because something suspicious was brought to the plaintiff's attention. That's exactly the argument the Computer Associates made, and this court rejected in all time, and for good reason, because it makes the discovery rule applicable in every case, and it makes it a jury question in every case. That the Neals are confusing this issue is pretty evident if you look at the cases they're relying on. The Neals cite a single case, which is Andretta versus West, which involved breach of fiduciary duty by the owner, the holder of the executive mineral rights. The court recognized in SV that fiduciary transactions are generally subject to application of the discovery rule. The Neals have an amicus brief filed on their behalf by the Scanlon Group. It cites a whole lot more cases That's the one with the three-page chart, if the court has seen it.
Ms. Barron, as to both issues that you're going to be arguing before, isn't the underlying question, as you're starting to allude to, the nature of the relationship between the lessor and the lessee?
Well, the nature...
And is it a fiduciary relationship? Is it agency? Is it a purely contractual relationship between two parties dealing at arm's length?
It's the latter. And certainly, I think the courts are in agreement generally about that. The Court of Appeals held there was no fiduciary duty here. The Neals have not come up on that issue, so there is not a fiduciary relationship. And there is testimony in the record that the only relationship between the parties is this contract, is this lease. Going back to Stanley Brief, those three pages, cases, those also involve breach of fiduciary duty, which we don't have. Or they involve claims of fraud or fraudulent concealment, which also we don't have. So those aren't this case. Those are seeing whether the discovery rule is satisfied, not whether the discovery rule applies as a matter of law. So we're back to question one under Altai in that case. And the Neals claims will be barred here unless they meet the Altai test, and that is they must be inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable. The Neals claims don't meet that standard for four reasons. First, they are participants in an ongoing regulated activity.
Let me ask you a question before you get into that.
Okay.
What is it that should have been discovered here? I don't think it's the lawsuit against ALP. Isn't it that the third party was graining?
That's what the Neals pleaded at page 4 of the transcript. They plead the discovery rule and say they could not have discovered basically AOP's conduct.
So
yes, that's correct.
And you don't disagree with that?
No.
Okay.
No, and they could have found that. They know that information at the Railroad Commission affects their interests. They had access to this information. This type of information was publicly disseminated in the local and trade press. And fourth, when they did make some efforts, they found it.
Let's back up. Let's assume for a moment that HEC did nothing, that they didn't go to the Railroad Commission and try to get restrictions on production, they didn't drill offsetting wells, and the drainage had continued for more than 4 years. Mm-hmm. Would that be inherently undiscoverable?
Well, are you saying that they only filed a suit?
They didn't file a suit. They didn't do anything. They just allowed the drainage to continue and took no action.
Well, HECI didn't have anything it could do on the lease to prevent the drainage. It's illegal drainage. They couldn't drill an offset well or pump water.
And I'm saying they took no action whatsoever. What would that be inherently undiscoverable if they were not fulfilling their lease obligations to protect the leasehold? Would that be inherently undiscoverable?
If there was no visible physical evidence or accessible documentary evidence that would have allow the Neals to discover that claim, yes, I think the discovery rule would apply there.
What do you mean by documentary evidence? What if there's evidence in HEC's possession that it's just not publicly available? Does that make a difference on whether it's inherently undiscoverable or not?
Yes, I think it does, because the Neals have to be able to have access to this information. And I don't think that we disagree with some of the...
What if they asked HEC for it?
What if they asked HECI for it and they failed to provide it?
I mean, it's the fact that they have the ability to ask for it bear on the analysis of whether it's inherently undiscoverable or not.
Well, I think if there is testimony in this record that it was HECI's policy, the president testified, that if they were asked for information, they provided them. And there's also testimony.
I'm just talking about globally.
But here, if
what
they
makes
asked for it, they
I'm
would
trying
have
to get at what makes it either discoverable or not discoverable.
Well, I think there has to be something that the plaintiff has access to that can give them some notice of the claim.
You see that there's a well on the other side of your lease line.
Right.
And do you have some obligation to ask your operator, are they draining us or not?
Well, I think the question would be, are they illegally draining us, which is a different question. And I think if there's no well on your lot, and you can see that right across the fence, there's a well over there, then you should ask your operator, are we being drained? Can you do something that would legally protect us against this drainage? Our case is problematic because it's illegal drainage, and there's nothing that HECI could do short of going to the commission and complaining.
Well, why, even if you see a well on your property, you're the royalty owner, and you see a well across the lease line, and you say, are we doing everything we can at the Railroad Commission to keep our property from being drained? Why is that any different?
Why is that any different? There are certain obligations you have under the lease, and there are certain obligations you don't. And the obligation under this lease would be to go and complain to the Railroad Commission.
Why is that different from if you have no well, drilling a well, in terms of what the royalty owner can ask the operator?
Well, the royalty owner can always ask the operator. In fact, the royalty owner has statutory ability to ask the operator for particular information under the Texas Natural Resources Code, under the 91501 through 506 series. A statute. So I think that they did have the ability to ask. If they had asked, they would have been given the information in this case. I think if the royalty owner asks and the information isn't given, and the information is in some private confidential file of the potential defendant, and the only way they can get it is to bring suit, then that may be a good case to apply the discovery rule to. That's not the case. We've got information everywhere. And particularly here, oil and gas is a regulated industry in Texas. Landowners and royalty owners, liking up the profit from oil and gas activity, know that action buyer at the Railroad Commission is affecting their interests every day. So it's no surprise to them that there's a lot of information about their wells at the Railroad Commission, and in fact, all the wells in the field. And here, I think we need to make this point. The Railroad Commission records were very straightforward. If they had gone to the 85 proceeding, there's a single-page order signed by all three commissioners that says, AOP is causing waste in the Jenny Wilcox field. In the 1988 proceeding, the Neals had to look no farther than the title of the proceeding, application HUCI to determine whether waste is occurring in the field. And there the commission found in its final order that AOP's excessive production was adversely affecting wells on the Neal lease. So they had this information, and they had access
Did the Railroad Commission filings also show that that problem had been corrected?
It had been corrected for the future, but it did not correct past occurrences, past waste, past damage, past drainage.
So if you went and looked at everything that was on file with the Railroad Commission, if I understand what you're saying, what it showed is that there had been past inappropriate drainage by AOP
right. That
had gone uncorrected,
yes.
But as far as the future drainage was concerned, that was all resolved.
Right.
And so by looking at that on its face, it kind of shows that looks like there were some damages here.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, could you tell from the face of the record? It could be that other operators would be allowed to overproduce vis-a-vis AOP and even it out.
Well,
did the record show that?
The record didn't show an adjustment in production, is my recollection. It also showed that there was water being produced by wells on the Neal lease, which is a sign of a fairly significant damage to the geological structure under the lease. So that was also in the Railroad Commission final order. What the Neals are really arguing is not that they couldn't find this information. They're just arguing they didn't have to go look for it, and that this would be, as a public policy matter, too great a burden placed on them.
You don't contest that your operator has an obligation to protect the leasehold from drainage. That's an implied obligation. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's a recognized obligation.
What is so onerous about, as part of that implied obligation, requiring the operator to notify royalty owners that they have a cause of action for damages for waste to the, or damage to the reservoir?
Well,
why is that not just a part and parcel of the obligation to protect the leasehold?
Because it's not protecting the leasehold. What it's protecting are their tort claims against neighboring operators. And it's not part of the lease. And if you look at implied covenants in Texas, there's some commonality when they have been implied, and usually it's when they will result in fulfilling the central purpose of the lease, and that's to obtain production. And here, the tort claim is not going to change the amount of production on the Neal lease. And it also doesn't require the lessee here to perform something that only the lessee can perform, like drilling a well to prevent drainage by an offsetting well. Here, the Neals always had control over their own tort claim.
Did the Neals have the ability to have the Railroad Commission complain about illegal production?
That's an operator's duty.
Did the Neals have the right to do that?
I don't think they do. I'm not certain, but I think that the operators appear before the Railroad Commission, and that is part of the duty to manage and administer the lease to go to the Railroad Commission and take administrative action that will protect future production from the lease. But this activity here, bringing a lawsuit, is something to the NEALTEC control of. They never assigned it to HECI, and HECI couldn't sue on their behalf. And I think the other problem with this duty matter,
yes,
is that it's unclear where this implied covenant starts and where it finishes. The court thought it was drafted something narrow, just saying you only have to tell us once you decide to go sue. But you can imagine just different little steps, like what if HECI had just gone over to AOP and talked to them and reached some kind of settlement without resorting to litigation? Would HECI then need to notify the NEAL? Or what if HECI knew about AOP's illegal waste but then negligently or recklessly decided not to sue? What we're requiring HECI to do is basically police everybody in the field and then go report to the NEAL any kind of smallest problem might be arising, just to protect itself against being a guarantor for somebody else's misconduct, illegal conduct in the field. And that's so far from what the purpose of this lease is that it really does suggest that it's best left to express agreement of the parties. And there are notice and information provisions in lots of different leases that are in the summary judgment record.
Any further questions?
I have a couple. I presume you read the amicus brief filed by the estate of Lloyd Benson?
Yes, I did.
And in there, they discussed at length about the difficulties that lessors or royalty interest holders have in determining whether or not they are being properly paid, whether or not there is drainage, different things like that.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying in this case that the problems discussed in the amicus brief for Lloyd Benson don't pertain here because it was obvious from the Railroad Commission filing that you wouldn't have to bring in all sorts of fields of experts to calculate all sorts of different things, that you could tell clearly from the Railroad Commission filing that there was drainage taking place that would put these folks on notice that they had a claim against AOP?
That's certainly true.
All right, a couple more questions. The other reasons why you claim that there was notice, or in this case, it made the situation not inherently undiscoverable, is because of a publication in a petroleum, what was the name of the publication?
I think Petroleum Information.
What was published in there? And how accessible is that? In other words, how realistic is it that this particular publication is something that all royalty interest holders are going to be consulted?
Well, I think what we need to look at, so it's at page 655 of the record, is my recollection. There, the president of HECI testified that he contacted the local paper so that they could write about the judgment, and then apparently it was picked up by Petroleum Information and discussed in there. We don't, the record doesn't have copies of the article or information about the circulation of these publications. The point of these publications, though, it's not whether they should have subscribed to them or should have known of them, but the fact that this information was publicly disseminated, both in the industry and in the community, don't make it impossible or very difficult for the NEALs to get wind of it. It's not that they have to read it, but that it would be generally open public information in the industry that could be likely to be discussed and get back to them.
Well, and because it was discussed in this particular case doesn't mean that in all situations, whenever drainage may occur, that it will be inherently discoverable like that, because not all situations of drainage are going to be discussed openly like that, are they?
Oh, absolutely not. There will be situations where it's completely under the ground and there's no way to find out about it through documentary evidence or through some kind of visible evidence on the property. That's correct.
Yeah, one last question. Why would it be reasonable or a reasonable expectation to place upon a royalty interest holder that they would have to scour through the records on file at the courthouse to see whether or not there is a lawsuit on file for them to know that maybe they have a claim also?
Well, there are two parts to that, I guess. One, that it's public information that's in the courthouse where the land is located. So it's public information that's in an area that's connected to where the injury allegedly is occurring. We don't have just that here, obviously. We've got big signposts that are pointing to the courthouse, both in the media publication and then in the Railroad Commission record. So if the information that's public is in a place where you know to go look for it and you have access to it, then it seems to me that we can expect people to pursue and protect their own economic interest in a contract and in real property by taking this action.
Any further questions? Ready to hear the respondent.
May I please the court, Mr. Harvey F. Cohen will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel for AGCI, and I disagree about a lot of stuff, but the first thing I disagree about is who's trying to confuse who. There are two questions in this case, and I think the first one is whether due diligence requires a royalty owner to routinely search railroad commission and district court records when there's no reason for them to look there.
Do we get the due diligence until we've determined that the event is inherently undiscovered?
No, Your Honor. I think the Altai test applies. We have another fundamental disagreement about
so how do you get past the, forgetting about due diligence, how do you get past the statement that this activity was not inherently undiscoverable because the activity was publicly disseminated? The information about this was publicly disseminated.
We look at the precedent and the legislation in this state about whether people are charged with constructive notice of public records. There are two categories of records that the legislature and this court have singled out as being constructive notice in all cases. Probate, and that's the Mooney versus Hillen case. And there's also the Liz Pendens records. And that's not even a filing in the district court's office. That's a lawsuit getting put in property records.
Constructive notice is not the issue. The inherently undiscoverable. Let me start over. The illegal pumping might be something that's inherently undiscoverable. But HEC's effort at stopping the illegal pumping is not inherently undiscoverable because that effort is done in a regulatory environment where filings are done with the Railroad Commission and these are public records. We're not talking about constructing notice to the lessors. We're just saying, is HEC's effort at stopping this a conduct that is inherently undiscoverable?
And our answer is, under the current precedent in this state, there is no requirement that a royalty owner would have to go to the Railroad Commission, which is the only place that they would find out about HECI's activity.
So your position then is that Railroad Commission records are inherently undiscoverable?
No, Your Honor. They're not inherently undiscoverable.
Why are public records inherently undiscoverable?
Public records are not inherently undiscoverable. The test has always been you have to have something that puts you on inquiry notice.
That's when the discovery rule has already been determined to apply, correct?
And you determine whether or not to apply the discovery rule by applying the Altai test.
And the Altai test, the first element of the Altai test is whether or not the matter is inherently undiscoverable.
Correct.
How is this different from an underpayment of royalty case, setting aside what may or may not be in the Railroad Commission records for the moment? Let's assume that the operator has underpaid the royalty owners. They've made certain deductions that they weren't entitled to make under the lease. Do we apply the discovery rule in a case like that?
Your factual distinction, Your Honor, is in those cases, every month the royalty owner is going to get a statement.
It doesn't show the deduction. Let's assume it doesn't show what was deducted. It just shows the net amount to use.
Then I think we're over into the fraudulent concealment area when we get down to litigate that case. But if at some point the royalty owner says, I believe I'm being underpaid, and there was nothing on the check detail every month, and there was no way for them to know what the price was that was being paid, is that part of your hypothesis?
Look, you get a royalty, let's assume that you get a royalty check every month and it says BTU at the price, and then you get your check, and it doesn't explain how that all was calculated. but there have been certain deductions that the lease doesn't allow you to take that were made before that amount was paid at Worldview. And that goes on for years. Do we say that that breach of the lease is inherently undiscoverable?
That situation is going to be inherently undiscoverable, and it's also going to implicate the fraudulent concealment. Because when it's the deductions, there's going to be no way of knowing other than the operator's records or the payor's records. If it was just a posted price case where they were paying you something less than a posted price, then you'd implicate the argument, could I have found out what the true price should have been? So under payment of royalties,
in Altai, we held that an undocumented theft of trade secrets is not inherently undiscoverable. How can a documented theft of oil be inherently undiscoverable, given that holding in Altai?
Your Honor, in Altai, you had factors that were cited in the court's opinion, which are not available here. Number one, you looked at the employer's policy regarding document control and found that that employer did not use a document control policy for trade secrets that was common in the industry. Number two, we said that the employer should know the marketplace. And if you see a competing product come out that you have been working on and the employee you have been working on it had now gone with a competitor, that should set off the bell. The inquiry notice should start. And that happened in the Altai case some 3 years before they filed suit. Those factors are just not present.
In Altai, but if you read Altai, isn't what happened in Altai is because if you looked, you could find it. The activity was not inherently undiscoverable. And isn't that exactly what we have in this case? If they looked, the activity would not be undiscoverable. You're trying to say, unless they're required to look, then the activity is inherently undiscoverable. But in Altai, it was just a flip. It was the reverse of that. In Altai, it said it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter about when you look. It only matters if you look. Would you find it? And in Altai, we said it's not inherently undiscoverable because if they looked, they would have found it. In this case, if they looked, they would have found it. So why isn't it discoverable?
Under that scenario, Your Honor, and under that reasoning, nothing is undiscoverable. And I don't believe that Altai stands for that proposition. Altai tries to take years and years of looking at discovery rule cases category by category. It'll apply to legal malpractice, but it won't apply to this type of case. Altai and FD and RV distill a test for when you apply the discovery rule. And if you look at what the courts of appeals have done since 1995, I think everybody out there believes that you are looking not at a specific category of case anymore, but you are looking at a two-part test that can be applied across the board. Altai works. It has worked fine. And it'll work in this case, and the Court of Appeals applied it correctly. The difference in Altai is actual notice, or something that the employer did that could have protected himself. There is nothing the Neils did in this case, or could have done, that a reasonable royalty owner should have done.
Okay, but they did find out about it.
They found out about the settlement of the judgment.
How did they find out about that?
The record reflects that they received a phone call from a lease broker in the area who just called up Mr. Neil one day in May of 1993, and that's in the summary judgment response.
Let me ask you this.
Before you ask that, can I interject?
Sure.
Is there anything, Ms. Barron argues that your remedy, you have your own cause of action against AOP. Do you disagree with that?
We did have our own cause of action against AOP. It would probably have been time barred by the time we learned about it. However, Your Honor, there are other points on that. First of all, that doesn't abrogate their duty to protect us under the implied covenant to protect the lease. There's the Ostrom case, Texas Oil and Gas versus Ostrom, cited in one of the amicus briefs and the Court of Appeals opinion, that suggests that they have the right because they are the owner of 100% of the oil and gas in place, that we conveyed that to them in the assignment. And finally, if you look at the proof that was presented, the evidence, the Court of Appeals said whether they sued for Daniel damages was inconclusive, and they didn't want to rule on that one way or the other. And they've come up with some after-the-fact explanations that really aren't as explicit as the testimony.
Yeah, but even if they had, let's assume that you still had time to sue AOP, and they'd recovered 100% for the reserves. That's no bar against you going in and getting what you want. AOP's problem, they didn't object to the jury issue. They may have overpaid these people, but isn't that AOP's problem, not yours or HEC's?
In that case, Your Honor, then the implied covenant would be meaningless. We have an election. We have two ways to go on it. Suppose we determine that their $3.7 million judgment against AOP was all the money in the world that AOP had, and we settled it for something less than because it wiped AOP out. And then the suit against AOP would have been a complete waste of time. Does that mean we don't have a right under the implied covenant to pursue these folks?
I'm just saying the fact that they sued AOP and recovered, may not have gotten the dollars, but got a judgment, doesn't wipe out your right to sue AOP, does it?
No, it doesn't. But it doesn't abrogate our rights to sue them, because they have the duty to us. They have a more direct duty to us than AOP does.
In the oil and gas industry in Texas, what would be wrong with a rule that put everyone who has an interest in oil and gas, whether it be a royalty holder or whatever, but for right now we'll confine it to royalty holders, what would be wrong with having a requirement that royalty holders are put on constructive notice of all information that is on file with the Railroad Commission? And before you answer, I want to say that in my question, I'm not going as far as the concerns that were expressed in the amicus brief filed on behalf of the estate of Lloyd Benson. I'm just talking about information that a person can pick up, look at, and comprehend without having to go out and hire multi-million-dollar experts. What's wrong with the requirement that all royalty interest holders are put on constructive notice of information of the Railroad Commission?
Nothing would be wrong if the legislature passed that statute and held everybody to that standard like they do with people who claim an interest in a probate case. But this court has never usurped the legislative function to make a class of records constructive notice, like probate or the dependent records.
You've said a moment ago that your cause of action with AOP was probably time barred client's death.
I guess implicit in that is the assumption that we didn't learn about it until May of 1990.
Why isn't that inherently undiscoverable? I'm having trouble seeing why you say, well, your cause of action against AOP is time barred, but your cause of action against HEC is.
No, they would have raised the same defense, but they would have had other defenses, like collateral estoppel, things that we would have had to address. It is no more.
But you said time barred. I'm just focusing on time barred. Is it time barred or not?
It would not necessarily be time barred. We would invoke the discovery rule in that same set of facts.
If HEC had done nothing, if they knew about the illegal production, if they could not drill an offset well, did not take any action with the Railroad Commission, and just let you be drained for 4 or 5 years, is that an inherently undiscoverable situation? Is that drainage?
Yes, it is.
And why is that?
There would be no way for the royalty owner to know that unless it, in this case, when there was overproduction, there would be no way for them to know that because they don't have engineers. Royalty owners typically do not have engineers that do annual reserve studies to tell that there is some damage to the formation. The record is not clear how HCCI determined that AOP was lying to the Railroad Commission. It's essentially what they did. They were filing false B1s and B2s every month and misstating what they were taking out of the ground. There is no way for the royalty owners to learn that. They could go to the Railroad Commission and see that AOP is reporting on their P1s and P2s what the allowable is. The record is not clear how HECI discovered it. Logical guess would be when they had annual reserve studies done, they would notice problems or notice increased water formation, increased water production, which would be indicative of problems, and that perhaps put them on notice that they need to look further at what AOP was doing. But the record doesn't tell us how that happened. Going back to your question, Judge, there is no case that's ever been decided in the state that says that the Railroad Commission records put a person on constructive notice.
Aren't typically the property owners put on constructive notice of all public records regarding their property?
No, that is not correct. A purchaser of property is on notice of things in the chain of title. But things happening after you already own it, you are not on constructive notice. This court has decided that in Wise versus Ojeda de Toca. There's a case out of San Antonio called Wise Scarver versus Lightfoot. They said the first purchaser, the purchaser is on notice. But at that point, the purchaser doesn't have an obligation to go check every morning to see if something has impacted his or her title. It goes back to an old Amarillo case called Clay versus Cox as well, cited in the Wise Scarver case.
And it's important that there's no case that helps them on the discovery rule. There's no case that helps you on the five counts, is there?
Amico versus Alexander does, Your Honor, because if that case stands for the proposition that the lessee's obligations are based upon and measured by the reasonable prudent operator standard. At page 568 of that.
But we've never said that meant giving notice.
No, but Amico came into this court in 1981 and made the exact same argument that you've never required anybody to go to the Railroad Commission and seek an exception. And the court said at page 568 of that opinion that we're not looking at a specific list, item by item, of implied covenants. Amico stands for the proposition that their obligations are based upon, and measured by reasonable prudent operator. And here they set the standard. They decided that Railroad Commission relief was inadequate to protect that leasehold estate. Now, I have
if
to...
If they hadn't, and had decided not to give you notice, you could quarrel about that.
If they hadn't gone to the Railroad Commission and hadn't given... Yes, we could have quarreled about that as well.
So
that would be a different case.
Just because they decided doesn't, in your view, end it. Whether they have to give notice may depend on, in your view, suspicions, actual knowledge, all sorts of things, negotiations, all sorts of things.
It's once they make that decision that that's what a reasonable prudent operator would have to do to protect the leasehold estate. They can't just do it to protect the 5/6. That's the flaw in their argument.
Well, but didn't they act as a reasonably prudent operator to protect the leasehold by going to the Railroad Commission, by getting the injunction, once they determined that the waste was occurring?
Yes.
And at that point in time, it stopped, and they protected the leasehold from further waste, correct?
Correct. Well, that's not quite accurate, Your Honor, because if you look at the record, the Railroad Commission filing was filed, the second Railroad Commission filing was filed simultaneous with the lawsuit. They decided they needed to vote.
Well,
and the Railroad Commission didn't reach their conclusion until 6 months after they settled this judgment.
But I understand, but to the extent you didn't make a claim that they didn't act as a reasonably prudent operator to stop the waste.
No, we did not make that claim.
So the claim really has to do with we have HECI pursuing its claims over against AOP. That's what the litigation was about.
The litigation was to enjoin them from overproducing and to get back the lost production, either through damage or drainage.
And by enjoining further waste, they did protect the leasehold by getting that injunction.
That was part of it, yes, correct.
So then we have them pursuing their own claim for damages that they, based on their ownership interest in that property.
Well, I disagree that they just pursued their own claim.
I understand that, but that's what they were doing.
They pursued a claim for damage or drainage. The records reflect that they went on alternative theory.
And what is the nature of the relationship then between HECI and your client? Is it contractual?
Purely contractual. The fiduciary has nothing to do with it.
Why can't two parties to a contract, each on their own, just decide to pursue their own tort claim?
They can, but the implied covenant is broad enough to require them that when they made the decision that the lawsuit for damages and injunctive relief was necessary to protect the leasehold, they had to protect it all. See, they're arguing back and forth past themselves on this. Either they did sue on Emile's behalf and they kept the money, which is unjust enrichment, and I think the evidence is pretty good on that, that they proved up 100% of the loss, or they didn't sue to protect the entire leasehold estate, and they should have.
Well, the injunctive relief that they sought to prevent further waste benefited the whole leasehold, didn't it?
Absolutely. Everything they did up to that last step
and then
was
for
the mutual benefit.
And then at that point, you could have sued for their damages that had occurred in the past.
For damages, their damages.
They had already occurred. There was, correct?
Not necessarily, because they proved up two measures of damages. One was the amount that AOP illegally took out of the ground, and that came to $1.6 million. And then they proved up also as a measure of damages how much the total reserves in each well had been diminished. That's the plaintiff's exhibit 21.
And
numbers.
That had all already occurred.
No, that was the alternative theory as to what they might not be able to get out in the future. That was, when they talk about the damage issue, it's what you would have got out in the future but for the increased water saturation.
If the Neals had an independent ability to sue AOP, how is it that HECI had the authority to sue AOP on behalf of the Neals?
Well, the Court of Appeals did not hold that they had that authority, but I think if you read the Ostrom case that's cited by the Court of Appeals and look at the very first paragraph of the lease, it talks about the lessee getting 100% of the rights to all the minerals at that point under the lease. And if they own 100% of it, they had the right to sue on the behalf of 100% interest. But that's not what the Court of Appeals held. I think it's arguable that they could have and probably did sue on behalf of
it. Let me ask you one quick question back on the limitation. Let's suppose this has been a blowout situation and you have a royalty owner who lives in New York, because I don't read the local newspapers. I don't have occasion to go to the newspapers or the Railroad Commission. Would a blowout situation be a discovery rule type case where the operator filed a lawsuit to recover for the lost hydrocarbon?
I would think you would apply the same test to that person. If it was the sort of thing that was published over the wire service and on the 6 o'clock news, this court has held in defamation cases that when things have such dissemination in the national media, they can become discoverable.
Miss, the whole county knows well below that. It's not inherently indiscoverable. It's just that you don't happen to live in the area. How do we square that with inherently indiscoverable?
Well, we have hundreds of thousands of royalty interest owners that don't necessarily live in the county where their property is. Do we want to require them to subscribe to the local paper? And which of the more than 100 trade journals do we want to require them to subscribe to? Suppose they put it in an oil and gas journal rather than Petroleum Information. You have to, I think that the Altai test would work just fine. And you start out, is it inherently undiscoverable? If there's actual notice, as most of these cases are, that's plausible. If there's such national or widespread dissemination that a reasonable person knew or would have known, that solves it. And when you get to public records, you say, is that person required by statute to go look? Did they have any reason to go look? What would they have found out had they gone? You got to get to that. That's the kind of test you have to apply to that. And that keeps you consistent with where I thought the court was going in all sides to get away from this, case by case or category by category jurisprudence, and try to come up with some unifying principles in this area.
Other than Amoco versus Alexander, is there any other case that you cite as authority for the proposition that HCCI, as a redevelopment operator, had a duty to inform the Neals of this illegal drainage?
No, Your Honor. It is purely an application of the implied covenant to protect the leasehold as stated there.
It is in Amoco.
In Amoco.
Starting with Amoco imposed on the lessee a duty to take action to protect future production. drainage in the future, not recovering damages for drainage in the past.
I'm trying to understand the equities here. Hesse knew of the illegal drainage.
Yes.
Made efforts stopping for a rail commission. That was unsuccessful. Got an injunction, and then sued for damages to the whole leasehold estate. And now you don't want to share those proceeds with the royalty owners.
Well, if I explained in response to Justice Adams' question, no, we couldn't get their damages, and two, we didn't. And I think Justice Owens was right when she said, even if we did, it's AOP's fault for not objecting to the submission and the damages that were awarded in that case. But the duty under Amoco is to protect the leasehold estate. It has to be part of the leasehold estate to require you to protect it. Future production is part of the leasehold estate. It will eventually be produced from the leasehold.
But you want to be compensated for the oil that has already been taken.
It wasn't really. We dispute whether it's been taken or not, whether it's a damage or drainage suit against AOP. But basically, what the damages number reflects was damage to the geological structure under the lease because of the water, early water production by a well on the Neal lease.
It was not your compensation for the product of illegally siphoned oil.
Even if it were, that's not part of the leasehold because there's nothing ATCI could do on the leasehold to produce that oil that was taken.
If it was compensation for damages to that leasehold estate, for the oil that was illegally siphoned off, don't you have a duty to share it?
Well, it can't be damages for part of the leasehold estate because the leasehold estate is looking to the future. The duties of the lessee are prospective. We're looking at what is the main purpose of this contract. The main purpose of this contract is to produce oil from our lease and to pay royalty under the express royalty provision of the lease. And the express purpose of the contract is not to go out and dig up litigation claims for your lessor. And that's what is common about implied covenants. What they say is they are only implied, they're disfavored. They are applied only if they are absolutely essential to accomplish the main purpose of the lease, which is production. And they also only apply when it's something only the lessee can do. The Neals admitted they have their own claim against AOP. I don't think that claim would have been time barred because of the false filings by AOP at the Railroad Commission. There would be claims of fraudulent concealment in that case against AOP that would probably permit the Neals claims to go forward. They argued that they hypothesized that we could have discovered possibly the damage based on an annual reserve report. It's not in the record how AGCI discovered it, but there are plenty of examples that express lease provisions. All of the GLO leases that the state uses require the lessee to provide to the lessor an annual reserve estimate. So if the Neals wanted that information, they could have contracted for it, and it would have shown them the problem if that's how we discovered it. Let me say one word about constructive notice. That's not the issue in this case. Constructive notice is a legal doctrine that charges you with actual notice. It's as if you really knew it. That's part two of all time. Did these plaintiffs know, or did they have constructive knowledge? The first question under all time is whether you could go and find it if you went and looked for it.
But if that were really the test, what would be inherently undiscoverable? Because we all have access to all information that exists. And if we can't discern what it means ourselves, we can go hire an expert.
We don't all have access to all information. I think we have the example of the trade secret information. Right. That's in a private file that you can't have access to.
And that's not inherently undiscoverable. If what you're saying that because it is information that exists, it is not inherently undiscoverable.
No, I'm really not going that far. Judge Evan, I think it's information that exists to which you have access. I think you have to be able to get a hold of it in order for that to work.
So does that mean that a landowner somewhere, if a lawsuit is filed that may affect that property without the landowner being served and he has a claim against someone else as a result of it, he's put on notice because that lawsuit was filed somewhere?
Well, I think certainly that's public information to which the landowner has access. I think this court can make some kind of determination on how connected that information is to the activity that's occurring that would put you on some kind of obligation to go look. Clearly, the Railroad Commission records here are absolutely directly connected to activities on the Mule Leap. There's no question about that relationship. If this information had been in the motor vehicle records or something, then that may have been inherently undiscoverable because it's not in a place that you that is connected enough to your transaction that you could be expected to go look for it.
So if we write the opinion in your way, would it not necessarily be a requirement, if not an implication, that all royalty owners in the future are going to have to keep up with all Railroad Commission filings?
Well, I think they're required to do that now because that's what the statute of limitations imposes on everybody, which is you have to monitor potential claims and you have to assert them in a timely way. And Neil have over a million barrels of oil under their lease, they can make an economic decision on how closely they want to monitor those claims. But I think the legislature has imposed that duty on them. And what they're saying is they're exempted from that duty and they're exempted from exercising any due diligence under the all-type test.
Wait, how has the legislature imposed that duty on them?
Well, it's imposed it on everybody by adopting a statute of limitations that says if you don't bring your claims within 2 years or 4 years, they're gone.
Any further questions? The following cases are submitted based on the brief and oral argument. The marshals are in the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable.